You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 25th of May 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and indeed review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, as the Cannes Film Festival draws to a close, we'll find out what's hot and what's not on the Riviera this year.
When I was pregnant with you, it was strange, you were different.
More on Only God Forgives and other films with Karen Krasanovich shortly. Later in the show, art, transport and technology come together in the form of a concept album entitled Nightbus. The DJ, producer, journalist and radio host Chris Coco will join us in the studio to play some highlights from the CD.
Plus, Monocle's David Pleasance guides us through Palermo's cultural offerings this weekend.
A good trip to the Sicilian capital is dependent on getting a good sense of orientation. Why not start in the geographical and spiritual heart of Palermo, the Quattro Canti?
And we'll be talking to Brent Elliott about what's blooming this year at the Chelsea Flower Show.
So, lots to look forward to this week, as usual, on The Review, here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House. This is The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Gillian DeBias. Gillian, have you done anything cultural this week? As usual, I haven't.
Well, I really made a point of dusting off all my work, and I peeled myself away from the office yesterday. And my favourite thing of all is to go to Covent Garden Opera House, and not just any old production. There was a world premiere last night of a new ballet.
And this was?
It was interesting. It was called Raven Girl, and it's one of the star choreographers at the Royal Ballet, Wayne McGregor. And he worked with the novelist, Audrey Niffenegger, who was, of course, the novelist who did The Time Traveler's Wife. And they worked for a number of years creating a dark fairy tale to translate in dance and movement. And it was fascinating because they also, it was a new score by Gabriel Yared, who does a lot of film music, and he's done The English Patient and Cold Mountain. And the whole production, it was contemporary ballet, but it brought in, it was almost like a silent movie or a graphic novel put to the stage with the dancers were almost more like gymnastics, incredible interpretation of a dark fairy tale.
So it works? is that a sigh of reverence?
I enjoyed
reverence
it.
Or
it
despair?
Was intriguing. I think it was more interesting than wonderful, but well worth seeing because it's you always see, you take lots of themes and you see how dance works with talented dancers. I think he tried a little bit too hard, but I love the process of seeing a new work unveiled.
That is, remind us of the name again, Raven Girl.
Raven Girl,
Wayne McGregor's new thing at London's Royal Opera House. It's 12:06 here in London. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to The Review here in London, where we head to Cannes, or at least we have talk of Cannes.
It's now in its 66th year, but the Cannes Film Festival, despite reaching retirement age, is still the premier film festival in the world, despite fierce competition from the likes of Venice, Berlin and Toronto. With its Riviera setting, Cannes is the festival that attracts stars. The stars pull the media and the media write the headlines that can make or break a movie.
And straight from the Cannes Quizette, joining us here in our London studio to talk us through her festival favourites is Monocle-friendly film critic Karen Krasanovich. Hello, Karen. Welcome.
Good morning. Very nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Well, we sadly didn't make it down to Cannes. We didn't make it down to the Quizette. But we heard about the heist. We heard about the rain from the front line of the festival. What was it like?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's, you know, people were complaining about the rain. It rains every year. Right. It, you can't. You go there thinking, oh, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be just wonderful. I'm going to go on that beach, because you never do, really. You're going to bring all your great shoes and your terrific clothes because you want to look glamorous, and then everything gets ruined. It was absolutely torrential. I mean, the soaking of the carpets and people just not wanting to go out. But that's standard. So, yeah, people were just shocked because that's not what they wanted. Wine, wine, wine.
I know, but for the promoters of Gatsby, like, they must have invested millions.
Yeah,
and in their head must have been this glamorous Riviera premiere. And it was puddles.
Yes, it was. It was very, very bad. And, of course, we had some wardrobe malfunctions with people trying to keep their clothing out of the water. But never mind. All makes for column inches.
Aside from the weather, which just sounds like it was in London.
Yes.
You might as well have just like stayed here and stuck a DVD on, really.
Absolutely.
What were the films actually any good? What were the films that were any good? I'm assuming some weren't.
Yeah. I mean, Cannes, above all, really makes you realize how very, very different people's tastes are in film. Your best friend will be there seeing exactly the same film. You will hate it. They will love it. And you begin to think, why am I friends with you?
What the hell is wrong with you people?
Exactly. What's wrong? And then you'll see something in Cannes which you will love because you'll be lifted by the sheer fatigue of the whole festival. And then you'll see it again here and you'll think, oh, it's not so great. So you get, it's very, very moody. I think one thing, before I talk about films, I want people to realize that Cannes, if you go there, Cannes is actually a lot of hard work because there are more crowds than ever. The police blow whistles all the time. The security has no logic whatsoever. They'll look in your bag. They'll ask you a question. You'll answer in bad French as I do. I meant to say inside. I said, I'm going to have a meeting outside. And they said, oh, okay. So, you know, like, fine.
Well, see, it's funny you say that because I haven't been, obviously, to nearly as many film festivals as you have. I've only been to a few. But I have discovered what I think is the key to enjoying them, which is under absolutely no account actually attempt to see any movies.
That is about right. And I saw very, very few this time. But what happens uniquely in Cannes is really, really old people come out to see the stars. And it's a crush, and they walk really slowly, and you can't get anywhere. And then, even now, families come out with the prams. So you have this huge, it's like Oxford Street times 10, and I have nothing against families and old people, believe me, I don't. But when I'm trying to get through screening, I do.
So there, okay,
I'll shut up. It's the same thing. It's like going to a rock festival and actually going to see any bands. Amateur's mistake.
You can't. Anyway,
you did actually do this. What did you see that you liked?
I saw a few. Well, I did see, and this is my film of the year so far, I know it's only May, is Behind the Candelabra, which is Steven Soderbergh's. He couldn't get this film financed in Hollywood. Went to HBO. HBO threw some money at him. What he wanted. He got Michael Douglas to play Liberace and Matt Damon to play Scott, his lover. And people are saying, well, you know, young people aren't going to know who Liberace is. You don't need to know.
Matter.
It's such an astonishing story. It's almost like fiction. And the fact that I'm old enough to have seen Liberace alive, it's now transcended into the perfect fiction. This man owned a world record fur cape that had its own car. And that's real.
That's probably one of those indications that you're making that little bit too much money, isn't it?
Yes, but you know, back then,
when you have a car for items of your wardrobe,
nobody cared. Nobody cared if a very, very wealthy bachelor who was dating Sonia Henning needed that sort of thing for his showmanship.
And how does Michael Douglas stack up in that role? Because he does have a history of, you know, he does the Michael Douglas roles, but he does occasionally enjoy himself by acting against type, and presumably this is that.
It's almost like a dog with a bone. He's just sucking the marrow right out of this. He just loves this role. You can see it. But the real revelation is Matt Damon. I had no idea he had this kind of range.
Well, I'm obsessed with just watching the trailer, so I can't wait to see the film. But his little mints, like, he just has the body language.
It's fantastic. Yeah, I was looking because I'm very, very aware of Michael Douglas's behind from Basic Instinct because we got a good shot of that. I haven't recovered. And he has the same behind here, strangely enough. But no, it's Matt Damon, really, I am just glued to my seat. And I just urge everybody to see it, really.
Okay. Well, what else made an impression?
Right. Well, Polanski's Venus in Furs, which I haven't seen because I came back early, is getting very mixed reactions. Again, very theatrical. It stars his wife, Emmanuel Seigner. And they're saying it's really a throwback to his earlier work. It's based on a David Ives play about sexual role play, about an actor and a very talented director. Actually, swap that around. A director and a very talented actor. That sounds fascinating. Because if you liked Carnage, and I feel kind of two ways about Carnage. It's theatrical, but it gives the actors this wonderful opportunity
and
to perform.
Can audiences are still willing to wave through the whole fugitive child molester thing?
You know, it's Cannes is actually very, very forgiving unless you talk about Nazis. They don't like that. But they sort of wave things. Although Jerry Lewis did get himself into trouble a bit by saying women weren't funny.
But isn't France famously literally the only country in the world that finds Jerry Lewis amusing?
Yes, which is odd. Yes, it is. It's very, very odd. They like Jacques Tati and they like Jerry Lewis. And yet they also like things that we like. So,
but you talk about Cannes being forgiving, but the critics do like to boo in screenings if they don't like something. Now, what was getting the boos this year?
Oh gosh. Well, Only God Forgives, which is Nicholas. Now, I still don't know how to say his name properly. I was listening to videos before I came out. So please, somebody say his name. Nicholas Winding or Winding Refn, I believe.
I think he deserves to be booed just for being caught, just for having the middle name Winding.
He's very satisfied with himself. He is. He is.
Director.
A film director. Yes. Second. He did Drive, and you know, everybody loved that. It was. Mm. You know, we fell in love with Ryan Gosling all over again, but in this, Kristen Scott Thomas plays a violent gangster mother, has her son Ryan Gosling avenge the death of his brother.
Okay.
And this got booed because. Now, like I said, I haven't seen it, but friends of mine were saying it was empty and violent.
I want to boo just at your summary of it, which is no reflection on the job you've done there. We do have a clip of this, to which I believe we can subject ourselves.
When I was pregnant with you, it was strange. You were different. They wanted me to terminate, but I wouldn't. I don't understand you. And I never will.
Boo. I enjoyed that. That was a clip from Only God Forgives, a fate-tempting title. It sounds dreadful.
Well, he said it's a story about a man who thinks he's God and another man seeking religion. And I'm thinking, okay. So we'll have to see what it's like. I mean, I thought Drive had a lot of terrific things about it. I did think it went over the edge. It's interesting. And they say that Ryan Gosling, who quote unquote plays a schmuck, still looks hot. And that's really all anybody cares about. They just want to see Ryan Gosling walking across the screen.
There was a lot of violence at Cannes that I thought was troubling people this year.
Yeah. What are you thinking of in particular?
Well, just, you know, not having been there, I think, as we see a lot of violence in the various films, but they're saying this year that a lot of critics were saying it was just too much.
Oh, yeah, well, violence is the new sexuality, and I think that's a bit sad, and that's kind of the way things are going. But this has been going on for a long, long time. I mean, a director said, Kaufman, I can't remember his first name, said he made Henry in June, which was a movie about Anais Nin, and he was saying, it's okay for you to chop off a breast, but you can't caress one. And I think that still is pretty much the same sort of thing. But on a more cheerful note, J.C. Chandor, who thrilled us with Margin Call, which is a wonderful, amazing, low-budget ensemble piece about the meltdown on Wall Street, comes back with a dialogue-free, now I haven't seen it, but I did interview him, film with Robert Redford and a boat. That's all there is. It's called All Is Lost, and they say it is absolutely brilliant and groundbreaking.
And apparently Robert Redford got a standing ovation.
Standing ovation, yes.
So the film is Robert Redford in a boat.
That's it. It's Old Man in the Sea.
Okay.
Without the fish.
You know, somebody did once have a hit with Tom Hanks and a football on an island.
There you go.
Dialogue free. So is this basically just 2 hours of Robert Redford in a boat?
Dead Calm without the thriller aspects.
Yeah, something does presumably happen at some point.
I think there's storms. I think he has to put on a slicker. No, I mean, J.C. Chandor is actually an amazing, energetic, very focused guy. And he's passionate about what he does. And when he was talking to me about this film, he didn't want to say too much. But he found that Redford was such an amazing presence and such a terrific actor, and the camera loves him still, that he felt that this was very promising. This is a risk, and I like filmmakers that take risks in this kind of way. Not necessarily sex or violence, although that can be interesting, but he's going into almost silent film categories where we don't rely on the cards and we don't rely on discussions. So it's interesting. There's also, if you shuffle along here, Asghar Farhadi's The Past, which I actually saw at the Palais. I got to sit in one of the jump seats. One of the rules about the red carpet is that if you're a woman, you have to wear a long dress. And a man, you have to wear a black tie. And this gets everybody shook up because nobody can tie a black tie.
You can get clip-ons.
Yeah, but they look like clip-ons. They do, and then they have the little spin, and then, and the clown cars. No, sorry.
Donned your long dress and sat in a jump seat.
Yes, I did. And and then they take pictures of you on the red carpet, which is humiliating. Anyway, this is the Iranian director's first French outing. It stars Berenice Bejo, who was so good, Oscar nominated in the Artist. And this is about a woman who comes back to try and get divorced from her Iranian husband. And they say it's a bit melodramatic, but it's absolutely wonderful. 130 minutes, and it feels pretty long.
We do have a trailer for this. This is The Past.
On va rentrer à la maison pour l'instant.
Tu m'as dit que notre maison c'était là-bas pour toujours.
Toi, tu dois rester ici avec moi.
Ce serait pas cette petite détruire sa mère.
C'est un malentendu.
Mais c'est quoi ce malentendu de merde qui pourrit nous vie depuis des mois?
It was a clip from Asghar Farhadi's The Past. Karen, what did you like about that?
She's actually, I didn't like her performance that much in The Artist, but I think she's really been given more range here. Obviously, she's playing an icon there. I think she's actually a really good actress, and I'm pleased to see this. Also, this is a more female-based story, if that's important, and it's more about the intricacies of emotional. I mean, it's like the separation in a way. It's more about the intricacies of people and relationships, and we don't get that a lot. So, and on the flip side, we have The Bling Ring by Sofia Coppola. You were going to say something?
No, I was just wondering about these are films in competition. I'm wondering about what you thought of the makeup of the jury and what they'll sort of make of these films.
I think the jury is always very interesting. If you see them as a lineup, did you see them as a lineup? It looked like the usual suspects,
Exactly.
Of course,
Spielberg heading the jury this year,
which is wonderful. I think it's really wonderful. Cannes is always does something controversial and puzzling, and I think having Spielberg on the jury was that. Although back in many, many years ago, they wanted to ask Douglas Sirk, the director, to the jury, and they got confused and asked Kirk Douglas instead.
It's an easy mistake to make. You're on the verge there of mentioning Sofia Coppola's new one, The Bling Ring.
The Bling Ring, which was, it's fun, it's frothy, it's glittery, and I think it concerns a bunch of kids who, based on a true story that was published in Vanity Fair, that robbed Paris Hilton's house. And considering there are now two jewelry heists at Cannes this year, none of my paste went.
Life imitating art.
I know. But I think what's really funny about this is that they see Paris Hilton at this party and they think, well, if she's at this party, then, you know, nobody's at her house. I bet you she left the key under the, you know, they say, oh, she's so dumb. I bet you she's left her house key under the mat. And she has.
There was a spate of burglaries of British footballers' houses a few years ago when burglars realised when they were playing away in Europe there would be nobody home, so they went and turned their houses over.
Yeah.
Although a couple of burglars famously failed to realise that Everton's somewhat burly centre-forward Duncan Ferguson was at home injured dropped round to try and clean him out. It went badly for them.
You see, you know, burglary, like everything else, you know, you just got to, you know,
you
have to up your game.
Yeah. You do your research. Any burglars listening, let that be the lesson you take away from this. Although they've probably realised right now that I'm not at home. Karen Krasadovich, thank you for joining us on The Review. Always a pleasure. Up next, we'll be looking ahead to what's on this weekend around the world with Nelly Gotcheva. But first, a quick break.
Come with us from
Georgia.
before we zip to
Istanbul
on Route 4 as we meet the people who are charting, finessing, celebrating and refreshing our metropolises.
You have to design a street for the speed at which a human being walks rather than for the automobile.
If you're trying to look at this place as an organ, it doesn't get enough blood. So it's on the verge of a heart attack, I'd say.
What's always attracted me about the square is that it is a London organism. It's something that's peculiar to this city.
The Urbanist is Monocle 24's show about the cities we live in that delivers insights into city halls, the views from the tops of towers, the stories of hidden rivers, and discovers why we still love that brutalist old beast, concrete.
Everything we use, touch, and our entire economy is based upon nature. The only difference now is that we tend to be less able to see that because we're living in a world of concrete, glass, and steel.
The Urbanist, presented by me, Andrew Tuck, premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time.
How far is the park? Does the park have a place where they can sit? Does the park have shade for them?
Join your fellow city lovers and leave the countryside to the people who prefer barns to bars and quiet walks to sidewalks.
And welcome back to Studio One here in London. You're listening to The Review. I'm Monocle 24 with me, Gillian DeBias and Andrew Muller. And time to cross now to Associate Editor Nelly Gotcheva to hear some cultural treats she's dug up from around the world this weekend.
If in London this weekend, stop by the Saatchi Gallery for Hermès Festival des Métiers, a rare glimpse into the fine craftsmanship of the French house's luxury products. Visitors have the opportunity to meet the brand's in-house artisans in an atelier-like settings and see them construct handbags, piece together fine jewelry and watches, and of course, get a glimpse into the printing of that famous Hermès scarf. Festival des Métiers is at Saatchi until Monday. Director Olivier Assayas has produced some of France's most diverse and intellectually unpredictable films of the past few decades. His new offering, Something in the Air, is out at selected cinemas in the UK this weekend. It follows the life of the 16-year-old high school student Gilles during the 70s in Paris. This weekend, the 19th century Bauhaus Museum in County Durham will feature the work of British fashion photographer Tim Walker. The Dreamscapes exhibition showcases 26 photos influenced by surrealism and British landscape painting. From floating beds to illuminated evening wear, this colourful and inventive collection is well worth the trip. Tim Walker Dreamscapes is at the Bauhaus Museum until the 1st of September. In Bordeaux, Musée d'Art Contemporain hosts a solo exhibit by Berlin-based artist David Liske. Entitled Platitude Normale, the show displays re-edits of Liske's previous creations. One of his most striking pieces is the self-portrait Every Work of Art is the Fatal Enemy of Each Other Work of Art, a vocal statement of Liske's self-narcissism. Platitude Normale is on until the 8th of September. And if you are in a festive music mood this weekend, don't miss the closing festivities of Primavera Sound in Barcelona. On Saturday, check out our favorite Dubliners, My Bloody Valentine. Sunday's highlights include LA's psychedelic rock band, Alalas. And now let's hear My Bloody Valentine with Off Your Face. Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
My Bloody Valentine with Off Your Face, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
Now, listening to music whilst travelling is one of life's great underrated pleasures, whether it's racing along a motorway to Pink Floyd, looking out a train window, listening to Chopin as the countryside rolls past, or matching your mood on an urban bus journey. Soundtracking your life is an art in itself.
Our guest music reviewer this week has taken this idea and run with it, or rather travelled with it. Chris Coco is a DJ, producer, journalist and radio host whose latest project, Nightbus, explores the space where art, transport and technology meet. Chris, welcome back to the review. First of all, Nightbus. Where did the idea come from and how does it work? Because the Nightbus is not something that Londoners tend to associate with a calm, settled, contemplative, relaxing journey.
The idea came from a conversation I had with my son, who's 18 and has just started travelling on night buses.
Just been introduced to the...
The joys of late night travel.
The joys is one way of putting it. For non-Londoners, we should probably explain that because we still have a tube system which closes at about midnight so we can all get up in the morning to bolt propellers on the Sopwith camels, the only way to get home without spending half a week's wages in a taxi is to get on a night bus, which are... It's kind of the raft of the Medusa on wheels, I think, is the... the best way of describing them.
It's always an interesting experience.
Interesting, again, your command of euphemism is commendable.
Exactly. I was chatting with my son Wesley about night buses and he said, oh, there's actually a musical genre called night bus. And I was like, wow, a new musical genre, fantastic. what's that? Thinking it would be something quite clanky and noisy with the sounds of people being sick into crisp packets in the background. And we kind of developed this idea and it started off as basically an art idea to try and make a soundtrack that would actually kind of disconnect you from the experience, but not so much that you wouldn't also listen to the things around you. So the kind of the definition of ambient music in that it's there and not there at the same time.
But I think you say it make you listen to things, but also when I was reading about what you're doing is make you observe and look. So kind of a soundtrack to open your eyes and look around and absorb.
Well, it's trying to create a pleasurable experience out of all the little details of your journey. So you might enjoy the rain dripping down the windscreen, for example, and with this music it helps you to relax and take it all in. That's the basic idea. But then after that I started not roaming around South London but exploring the wilds of South London, and I kind of hooked up with a group of creative young artists that, again, with the help of my son, of course. So we've actually got two things. We've got this conceptual arty idea of ambient music to listen to on a bus, but also quite an exciting group of young producers who, if this works out, will spin off and start making EPs of their own and developing this kind of quite London style of music.
So the music that you've chosen for us today, does it all fall into what we are going to call the night bus genre?
I don't think there really is one, but I guess it does in that it's kind of contemplative, modern electronic music. I mean, you can't go much further than that, but that's kind of...
And urban?
And yeah, urban, because it's basically people who've grown up in the city with all the sound of the city, as you're talking about soundtracking your life, but the actual soundtrack without putting any music into it is this kind of noise of the city, the drone of traffic and voices from all over the world, like all mixed up together in London. That's what you hear all the time. So they've grown up with that, and then it's trying to turn that into music.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's try one of the tracks you've brought in. This is Dirty Beaches with Night Walk. And before
this
before
one's
we play
not
it.
Actually not on the album.
Okay.
This is the other thing that I was going to talk about.
Okay, but nonetheless, can you introduce Dirty Beaches to us?
Yeah, I mean, he's a Japanese artist who uses drum machines and lots of reverb and noisy guitars and stuff like that. But again, it's kind of moody, contemplative music. Different style because it's Japanese. But, well, have a listen and you'll get the idea.
Thank you.
was Dirty Beaches with Night Walk as opposed to Night Bus. That's the first selection of this week's music reviewer, Chris Coco. That wasn't or isn't on your Night Bus project, but is it a million miles away from the kind of things that are?
Not really. Is that I always get drawn to this kind of moody, spacey kind of music. I don't know why. It's just it's personality thing, I guess. So no, it's not, in that it's kind of a bit moody, but kind of makes you feel good at the same time.
Okay. Well, then the next song I want from the songs you bought that I want to move along to, I understand this one actually contains some verite recordings, if you will, of actual Night Bus.
It does, from the 344.
From the 344, yes. And which is the title of this track. Jamie Isaac, introduce him.
He's one of these South London guys who I've hooked up with, who are from kind of Peckham Nunhead area, which means nothing to most people, but it's kind of deepest southeast London, basically. He's actually an interesting character because he was when he was a kid, he's now like 19, 20, but when he was really young, he was in a choir and they were really big in Japan. So he can't actually go to Japan because he gets mobbed by by fans in Japan. So he's changed his name. Rechristened himself Jamie Isaac, plays piano really well and sings and uses computers to make interesting music.
But he's still riding night buses.
Absolutely.
This is Jamie Isaac and 344. Jamie Isaac and 344, the second selection of today's musical reviewer, Chris Coco. We could hear the bus sound there, of course, and that is a very pretty piece of music, but I would venture to suggest that it's not evocative of most Londoners' recollections of travelling by night bus.
No, well, I think that's the point of it, is that you've got to balance out the experience, so you need something that's quite calm and soothing to take you away from the nastier aspects of travelling on the bus.
I would counter that. It depends what night buses you're on. I think there's a lovely loneliness on some night buses when you're literally the only person on the bus.
If you're really lucky.
You've had some bad experiences, haven't you?
We live in different parts of London, obviously. When I hear that, though, I mean, when I'm traveling, whether it's on a bus or a train, and I have I'm listening to music, I make films in my head, and I see these also, you know, as soundtracks to films. Do you take this music? Are you having any collaborations with filmmakers?
Well, Wesley, my son's actually he's studying at Goldsmiths at the moment. He's studying film,
and the have to meet your son,
and I have to bring him in next time. And the idea is to try and make a visual equivalent of this. He actually took photos for the cover, which obviously you can't see at the moment, but it's very beautiful in itself. And the idea is to use these as soundtracks. They are, as you've discovered, like soundtracks for your bus experience, if you like.
Okay, there's another track I wanted to move along to. This is, appropriate to so far the summer we've had this year and, frankly, the two summers we've already had in the previous 2 years in London. This is called Rainy Summer. This is by CSL. Who are CSL?
Well, that's the odd one out on the record, which means that it's actually me.
cunningly disguised. Well, this is you, then, with Rainy Summer. Thank you. And that was CSL, aka today's guest music reviewer, Chris Coco, with his track Rainy Summer from his new project, Night Bus. Was that in fact inspired by the singularly wretched weather we've been having for about 300 years now?
I think that's where the title... It's always hard to find titles for pieces of electronic ambient music. You never know what to call them, and it's silly to call it Project Number 74 or whatever, because then you get very confused. So, yeah, it was inspired by by that.
Are you planning to take the Night Bus idea further? Will there be Night Bus 2?
I really want to do that. Obviously, it depends how many we can sell. But I really want to do that. I'd like to do Night Bus in from different cities. So I'd love to do a kind of U-Bahn Berlin one, for example, or a Leeds Night Bus one, or and try and do the both things, like find this music for dreaming and looking out of the window, but also find groups of new interesting producers from different cities. I think it could work really well.
It's a great way of bringing together and finding new talent and working with different talent. How do you find the talent for this bus project?
Is it, you start off looking on SoundCloud and then start, or you know, various different music websites, and you start talking to people, and then they introduce you to other people, and it all follows on from there. And then it gets really exciting when you start meeting people in pubs and kind of looking around going, I wonder who it's going to be, what they're going to look like.
It's like a dating game.
And on that somewhat optimistic thought, Chris Coco, DJ, producer, journalist and radio host, thank you very much for joining us. That was Chris Coco, this week's guest music reviewer on The Review. His latest project, Night Bus, explores the space where art, transport and technology meet. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. And it's time now to go to Palermo to hear what's coming up there over the coming days. David Pleasant is here to guide us through it.
A good trip to the Sicilian capital is dependent on getting a good sense of orientation in this sprawling and sometimes confusing city. Why not start in the geographical and spiritual heart of Palermo, the Quattro Canti, the splendid, opulent crossroads in the centre? In the palace at one of the four corners of the crossroads, you'll find the gallery of Francesco Pantaleone. This almost secret contemporary space is contained in a former department store and is currently hosting the work of Mexican artist Julieta Aranda. The exhibition, entitled Where There's Smoke, is a thought-provoking look at the process of revolution, told through low-res images, sculpture and video installations. Sticking with the contemporary, increasingly edgy mood that Palermo is becoming well known for, head to the Centro Culturale Cantieri Zisa. This former industrial plant has become the city's foremost art quarter, with galleries and vast event spaces giving young creators much-wanted room to breathe. This weekend, the Zisa's Art House Cinema is holding a retrospective of Israeli documentary filmmaker Eyan Zivan, who has been praised for his frank and open criticism of his country of birth. After that, why not catch a concert at the Festival of Independent Music taking place at the superb Teatro Garibaldi in the scruffy and up-and-coming Calça district. Music Manifesta 1.0 will showcase some of the best of Palermitan and international talent. The space at the newly refurbished theatre is well worth a visit in its own right. And despite the well-organised and minimalist surroundings, it happens to be occupied by a group of cultural activists. First on the lineup are experimental electro-rock band Hank, with songs from their new album, Public Acts in Obscene Places. For Monocle, I'm David Pleasant.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back with a survey of this year's centenary of the Chelsea Flower Show.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as
trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Angie Muller. Now, 100 years ago, the Royal Horticultural Society Great Spring Show was moved from Temple Gardens in the centre of London to the grounds of the Chelsea Hospital. 100 years later, the Chelsea Flower Show is the most famous garden show in the world.
This year's event, which winds up later today, has been somewhat controversial. The judges and the judging criteria have been heavily criticised. Well-regarded designer Christopher Bradley Hall publicly dismissed the panel as a bunch of also-rans. The chief judge, Andrew Wilson, later tendered his resignation, complaining that his own garden didn't get the gold medal to which he felt it was entitled. And joining us now to talk us through the show's history and its present is the historian Brent Elliott, author of the official centenary celebration of the Chelsea Flower Show. Welcome to the programme. I think most people generally think of gardening as a calm, contemplative, idle pastime. Is the Chelsea Flower Show always this competitive?
In one sense, yes, the Chelsea Flower Show is always this competitive. But until the 1990s, at the earliest, we didn't tend to hear protests about judging.
And what has brought it on?
I don't think I'm in a very good position to say that. Peter Seabrook responded to the latest fuss by saying that in his day, you entered the Chelsea knowing that you were in for it and what might happen. If you didn't get the results you thought you deserved, you just bit your lip and got on with things. And for its first 80 years or so, that rule held.
And this year, you know, it's the centenary year, and so they've pulled out all the stops. What were some of the highlights to you, and how did it sort of, did it pull on its past sort of 100 years heritage?
It certainly pulled on its past. If you entered the Great Pavilion, you saw period photographs of Chelsea festooned all around the interior of the Pavilion.
The great British tradition.
We haven't had a marquee since 1999. And the library staged an exhibit of photographs, and we've also had the Plant of the Centenary competition, the results of which should now be finalised, but I haven't yet heard what they are. And various individual stands have either tried to convey an impression of the development of gardening in one or other aspect over the past century or have focused on some particular decade. Kelways incorporated some of the original garden display material from their first Chelsea show in 1913.
You are, as we mentioned in the introduction, the author of a rather beautiful book celebrating the centenary of the Chelsea Flower Show. What's your personal history with the event? What's the first one you can recall going to?
1977 is the first Chelsea that I went to. So I've been to all the Chelseas since then.
And how have you seen it change in that time, apart from people complaining when they don't win?
The most obvious changes have been the great increase in the number of gardens. And since the 1990s, the arrival of gardens whose content was determined not by a horticultural theme, but by an architectural, sculptural, or philosophical theme instead. Also, of course, until the 1980s, all show gardens tended to occupy sites of similar size. The provision of sites for small gardens, originally called courtyard gardens, but then the numbers of categories started diversifying. That began in the late 1980s and made it possible for the first time to show design ideas for the very small garden.
You talk about themes, and I think this year there are a number of themes for charities. There are a number of gardens that are organized in charities. How have the flowers and the presentations matched and propelled the ideas behind the good of the charity?
There's no single answer to that question because some charities sponsor gardens that really try to depict the subject of their charities, mm-hmm. directly or symbolically. The garden that Chris Beardshaw did for Arthritis UK incorporates wire mesh figures in various sportive postures, perhaps indicating things that people with arthritis would like to be able to do but can't. On the other hand, some charities have been quite content to sponsor gardens that are simply interesting-looking gardens hoping that the fact that they are associated with the garden will be sufficient publicity for them. So there's no rule governing this. It's up to the individual's charities.
One of the charitable initiatives that did attract a bit of attention this year, and I think you know which one I'm going to mention, was the one-year lifting, I think, of Royal Chelsea Flower Show's ban on the gnome. What did you make of that?
Gnomes were never actually specifically mentioned in the schedule as a forbidden item until the beginning of the 1980s. But they had been covered from the very beginning under the category of brightly coloured garden ornaments.
It's a fabulous euphemism.
It is possible that some degree of attempted persuasion by garden gnome manufacturers had led them to the shows department to specify gnomes in the early 1980s. But I would say that the ban on garden gnomes is an example of what you might call neo-Georgian garden taste.
I like the idea that there was a darkened room full of manufacturers of garden gnomes plotting at some point.
I'm not sure that it involved a darkened room, but there is, I've certainly seen correspondence from gnome manufacturers more or less demanding that they be allowed in at Chelsea. And every now and then, there's a protest in the streets outside by some manufacturer of garden gnomes declaring it unfair that his products are not allowed.
He could organise quite a big protest. He could just get loads of little gnomes with placards. I'm amazed they haven't thought of that.
Now, with the Chelsea Flower Show, much like, you know, Crufts Dog Show, they have awards and Best in Show. Who was the winner for Best in Show, and what did you make of the winner this year?
The winner this year was the garden that Trail Finders and Fleming's Nurseries created, with Philip Johnson as the garden designer. Every year that Trail Finders and Fleming's have been working at Chelsea, they've had a different garden designer each year. So I've now forgotten how many years it is. It is at least 8 or 9 years that they have been there. And Fleming's have said that when asked why an Australian nursery should be sponsoring a garden at Chelsea, so it meant that every May, attention on the Australian media was focused on gardening for a little bit to see how this Australian garden did. And it gave them the platform for trying to promote horticulture, request more grant aid from the government, etc. So they have declared that this is the last year that they're going to be involved, and I'm quite sorry about that.
And what was special about the garden?
First of all, from one point of view, it was a rock garden on the Rock Garden Bank, where rock gardens traditionally were located, as you can tell from the name, but where years can go by without a single rock garden appearing nowadays. So for the centenary, that in itself was appropriate. It contained a most amazing structure, this replication of the geometric pattern of a warata flower, and it was simply a very well-done garden.
We were speaking to our previous guest, the music reviewer, in an entirely different context about the effects of the recently abjectly terrible weather in this country. The last two summers have been atrocious, and this one's not looking terribly promising. How fearful are people working in horticulture about this? It must have a huge impact on their business, because no one goes to garden centres because no one wants to spend spring standing in the rain planting.
I think that many nurseries are quite fearful, but not yet fearful enough to be panicking. It has been a bad year. Some of the exhibitors at Chelsea have had their stands suffer because plants failed to open on time, etc. This is always a difficult thing to judge, but the weather in the past couple of years has been so unstable, it's been very difficult to calculate the right point for starting forcing activity and bringing plants out of hibernation, putting them into the oven, and so on. And yes, earlier this year, there was a significant drop in the normal rate of retail activity at garden centres around the country, so it is worrying. How much of a trend this is as yet, we don't yet know. But if it carries on for a few more years, then we'll be more than worried.
Now, Britain is known as being a nation of gardeners. When it started, was the Chelsea Flower Show a uniquely sort of British event? And now how much of the international spotlight is on Chelsea?
It was not a uniquely British event. In virtually every year that Chelsea has been going, there's been at least one foreign exhibitor. There were two French nurseries exhibited in 1913. There was a German nursery in 1914. And then, strangely enough, there were no more German nurseries until well after the Second World War. Up until the Second World War, all the foreign exhibitors at Chelsea were nurserymen or sundriesmen. The first garden designed by an overseas organization was in 1947 or 9. The Spanish Society of Friends of Parks and Gardens created a Spanish-style courtyard garden at Chelsea. And Since then, there's some foreign firms and foreign horticultural societies exhibit quite regularly. Kirsten Bosch, who's centennial, it also is this year, coincidentally, the great South African Botanic Garden. They have exhibited many times at Chelsea. The Barbados and the Trinidad and Tobago Horticultural Societies are regular exhibitors, etc.
And do you think, though, that Chelsea still says something definitive about the British attitude to gardening? I mean, you mentioned there earlier the Australian exhibits which have come to Chelsea, and I grew up in Australia, and most of the places I grew up in had gardens, but it's a very different thing, gardening in Australia, because you have to be perpetually aware that literally any second something could rear up from your quarter acre plot and tear your face off, whereas like the British garden, it's slightly more contemplative, I
more
think.
More tame.
Yeah. What do you think is the sort of the definition, I guess, of the British way of gardening?
If I knew the definition of the British way of gardening, we wouldn't need to have garden historians writing long histories on the subject. The British way of gardening can be subdivided in many ways, many of them to do with class, because when the Chelsea Flower Show started, a third of the exhibitors of plants and flowers were not commercial nurseries, but amateur growers, meaning by that the proprietors of great country houses which had extensive gardens and whose garden staff created the exhibits. The last such exhibitor was Morris Mason, and he stopped exhibiting in the 1980s. So the shift from the country house garden to the small domestic garden as the focus of the country's horticulture and of the retail sector in horticulture has made a great many differences. Many of the attitudes associated with the country house garden continued for a long time, and the fashions that were started there continued. The arrival of the modernist movement in gardening, which at Chelsea took place in 1962 when the Institute of Landscape Architects commissioned a garden designed by the young John Brooks, that was much more easily adapted to the small domestic garden than the garden based on the bedded out parterre and the herbaceous border had been. But it nonetheless took a long time to penetrate. People continued trying to make their gardens, in effect, a smaller scale version of what they had known as the country house garden. And it was not until the 1970s and the gradual spread of John Brooks's idea of the garden as the room outside, an extension of the house, just different attributes and no canopy, etc., that the domestic garden really came to its own as a distinct form.
Brent Elliott, author and historian, most recently author of the centenary celebration of the Chelsea Flower Show. Thank you very much for joining us here on The Review. And that brings us to the end of our Saturday Review. So for now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. The show today was produced by David Michon and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. And special thanks to Audrey Letendart.
We're handing back to Georgina Godwin with this weekend edition next, where you can catch up our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air Sunday at midday London time.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Julian DeBias. Have a good weekend.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.